host of Shoe Untied. Today, I'm very pleased and super honored to have as my guest Scott Adams, who's the creator of the very famous and well-known Dilbert cartoon series. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
So, Scott, I'm sure you've told this story a thousand times, but I have, since I don't know the story, tell me how on earth you created the Dilbert cartoon and what were you doing when you did it?
Well, that would take us back to the late 80s. And Dilbert launched in 1989, but it wasn't until after about 16 years of working in the corporate world, first at a big bank, Crocker National Bank, before it was swallowed up by Wells Fargo, and then later at Pacific Bell. And part of the inspiration for Dilbert was the horrible discovery that when I left the banking world and I thought I had put all those big corporate bureaucratic problems behind me, that I discovered they were identical in the world of Pacific Bell. And I thought, hey, maybe this is happening everywhere. Maybe I should make a comic after that. So that was sort of what inspired it. But I could give you the long or the short version of how I got started. But the executive summary is that I wrote to a cartoonist who gave me some advice about where to send samples. And other than that, I just drew up some samples and sent them to the big syndication publishing houses, and United Media accepted me. There's a long version of that, but that's the short version.
Well, how did you get the name Dilbert?
That was actually suggested by a coworker of mine who was actually my boss back at Pacific Bell. And I would draw Dilbert on my whiteboard in my cubicle. And people would come by, and they liked it, but he didn't have a name. And they kept saying, what's his name? So I had a little contest in the office for people to help me name him. So people would come in, and they'd put a name on the board and say, well, I think he should be Poindexter or Simon and, you know, all these nerd-like names like that. And then my ex-boss came in, and he just wrote the word Dilbert on the board. And I swear I saw the future. Now, I found out when it was too late to change it that the reason he thought Dilbert was a perfect name is that he'd seen a comic named Dilbert, but he didn't remember it. And it was a comic drawn for World War II flyers, you know, the people who were training to fly jets for the Navy. And there was something called the Dilbert Dunker, which is something that they would – practice, you know, a jet landing in the ocean and how do you get out of it if you're still alive. And there was a cartoon named Dilbert that was sort of a safety comic for the Navy. It was, you know, don't do this, don't do that, don't be a Dilbert. But it was too late to change mine, and I never had a problem with that. Nobody from the Navy ever contacted me.
That's funny. So as soon as he said that name, you immediately thought, okay, that's the right name? Like, or did it take a while for it to grow on you too?
It was honestly like a sensation of seeing the future. I felt like I went down a long tunnel, looked at the future, and then got, you know, sucked back, you know, up the tunnel. You know, I only got a glimpse of it, but I was so sure that that name was not only the name of the character, but was meaningful for the rest of my life that I could feel it in my entire body. It was the most singularly weird, creepy, amazing experience of my life, I think.
Now, what did you do at Pac Bell and the bank? What did you do there?
Well, I had a degree in economics, so banking was just sort of a natural thing for an economics major to do. And I started as a bank teller because I moved to San Francisco with nothing but two suitcases and $2,000 in the bank that I got for graduation. And I just walked into a branch of the bank and said, I need a job. And sort of quickly, you know, ideally by the end of the week so I don't starve to death. And they offered me one. So I was willing to start at the bottom as a teller, and then I worked my way up, and I got put on a training program, and they're pretty good at training you if you're interested. And then when I went to the phone company, I was doing budgeting and financial business case analyses, that sort of thing, for the technology side. And then I was a pretend engineer, there was some bureaucratic issue that made them need more engineers, but they couldn't hire any. Mm-hmm. So my boss said, well, you're an engineer now. So I pretended to be an engineer for a few years.
So the material that ended up being the subject of your Dilbert cartoons, were these ideas that you like started jotting down when you were at Pac Bell? Or, you know, how did the whole idea of, you know, hey, I'm going to start making fun of these things start coming together?
Well, actually, the comic Dilbert was about a guy who had a job, but he didn't actually spend that much time at the office. I had designed it as sort of a generic cartoon about a guy and a dog. But people started writing to me as soon as I put my email address in the comic, which was a few years after it had launched. And it wasn't doing very well. It wasn't being picked up in many newspapers, and it was on a sort of a failure vector. But once I started running my email address in the strip, once email became a thing in early 90s, people wrote to me and said, hey, we kind of like your comic a little bit when he's home, but we like it a lot when he's in the office.
Oh, interesting.
So I just changed it, and that's when it started to take off.
Oh, I see. So the stuff about the office, I mean, was that based on a lot of your experiences working in those companies?
Yeah, so for the first few years, I continued working my day job while I was drawing the comic. So once I knew that that's the type of material people wanted, every meeting I was in was solid gold. You know, and I found this weird experience that it turns out that once you're mining your job for cartoon fodder,
yeah,
you don't care what goes wrong. Yeah. So it turns out that when you're a cartoonist, there's no such thing as an entirely bad day, because you know the worst case scenario is you've already finished your work for tomorrow. You know, it's like, well, that's a joke. That's tomorrow. I got that one done. So yeah, it was sort of the perfect combination of jobs. You know, one was frustrating me, and one was letting me get my frustrations out.
Now, were you an artist before? I mean, are you an artist by nature? I mean, I assume you like drawing. I mean, did you do other cartoons and stuff before you did the Dilbert?
No, Dilbert was almost the very first thing I tried. A year before, I tried to get published in magazines. What is called gag comics. They're sort of different every time, and it's just one joke in one panel. But I only tried that once, submitted some comics to The New Yorker and to Playboy because they paid the most, and they both rejected me, so I forgot about that. But a year later, I raised my sights and tried to get published in actual newspapers.
Hmm. Well, isn't the real genius behind Dilbert? I mean, obviously the drawings are pretty simple, but I assume the real genius is almost the brevity of the words, the cleverness of your – I mean, because the Dilbert comics, he says very little. I mean, you must have some talent or something in able to kind of capturing those awkward moments that you do in the Dilbert cartoon.
Well, you know, I write about this in my latest book, the How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big. I talk about systems for success, and one of them that's important to me is layering together a bunch of skills that work well as a package, but you don't have to be the world's best at any of those things. So consider that I'm a world-famous cartoonist. But if I'm sitting in a room of, let's say, 50 people, there's almost a guarantee that two or three of those people are better artists than I am.
Right.
So I'm not a world-class artist. I'm just, you know, barely good enough to be a cartoonist, and that was a close call. I also never took any courses in writing, with the exception of one course on business writing, which teaches you how to be brief. It teaches you how to, you know, get to the point really quickly. And it teaches you how to, you know, basically write active sentences instead of passive sentences. That's the big mistake everybody makes. And then I, you know, I've been practicing that for now 27 years. So I got good at it, I guess.
So after Dilbert took off, did you have the concern about finding enough material for the cartoon strip? Because, I mean, obviously, you know, you're one person. I assume you gave up your job at some point. Like, what did you do for the content of the cartoon strip?
Well, for the first several years, I was at work. And then after that, up to, you know, 1,000 people a day would send me emails, often with suggestions. Now, as time goes on, email is sort of less of a communication vehicle, and at the moment I'm using social media for more of it. So about 2 hours ago, I was on the Periscope app. That's one of Twitter's companies, I guess, that allows you to live stream anytime you want, just from your phone or your iPad. So I just turned it on whenever I want, and this morning, I guess about 50 people jumped on from all over the world, and I said, "Hey, I'm the Dilbert cartoonist. Who's at work? And what's bothering you? Give me some ideas." So I probably got, I'm looking at my notes right now. So I got some ideas about hiring a disruptor at work, somebody who's, trying to change too much. I've got somebody who goes on vacation, but his boss makes him work on vacation. These are just ideas that came in just this morning.
Yeah, that's interesting.
About using dashboards at work, about Dilbert. Somebody suggested that Dilbert reads the book that I wrote. Just make it kind of a meta joke. But so social media is a little more important to that now. But I also run my own business, and I've got a startup that I'm about to launch in a month or so. So I'm pretty deep into the business world in general.
Hmm. Now, tell me a little about how Dilbert has changed as a character from when you started him. Has he matured? Has he gotten more cynical? What would you say about Dilbert?
Well, Dilbert is a product of the times. So as the times change, I try to change him to go with it. So in the mid-90s, for example, all the headline news was about downsizing. There were big layoffs all across corporate America. So Dilbert, being sort of the face of the corporate employee, he was also in that horrible downsizing environment for a number of years. And in that environment, you keep your head down and you're just worried about not getting fired. But it didn't take long, the dot-com explosion and since then, that engineers and technical people are always in demand. So at this point, Dilbert's confidence has swung completely to the point where he can insult his boss to his face, and the boss isn't going to fire him because it's just too hard to hire another engineer. So that's the biggest change.
Has he always been an engineer, or does he sort of have different jobs or not really any job? What is Dilbert supposed to be in terms of his profession?
Well, I always call him an engineer, but he's a little bit of a Rorschach test in the sense that people see what they want to see. Mm. So people who are computer programmers, they think, oh, he writes code, he's a software guy. And I do have him writing code a lot. And other people just say, oh, he's a guy who works in an office in a cubicle, just like me. So I give people as much room as possible to find something to relate to. I try not to over, describe Dilbert, because that would make him harder to relate to.
Hmm. Now, do you ever go back and reread your old Dilbert cartoons, or do you ever do that?
I do. You mean just to see if I still like him?
Yeah, or see how well he stood through the test of time or whatever.
Yeah. Well, comics generally don't stand the test of time, more than, let's say, 10 years, because just too much has changed about the world. But also, what passes as comedy changes, and you don't really notice it because it changes gradually.
Right.
But if you were to, say, go back to the 40s, the jokes were sort of vaudeville jokes with a punchline and a setup, and there'd be a proper punchline at the end of the setup. By the time you got to, say, the 70s, and then Saturday Night Live was a big thing, humor became being inappropriate. So what was funny was making a joke that would make someone uncomfortable. So it was too sexual, too much about drugs, that sort of thing, too much about violence. So the more inappropriate it was, the more people thought, oh, that's what humor is. And I think that has morphed again, sort of slowly and over time, so that today what qualifies as humor is closer to reality. Hmm. So our reality TV shows, we watch almost like they're humor, because we're like, we can't believe that's happening. And Dilbert is really sort of a reality-based comic. That's what makes it funny, is you say, oh, my God, my coworker does the same thing, or I do the same thing. That's why you laugh. And I think Seinfeld was a big part of that. The first really famous property that was just talking about what happens in a normal life.
Hmm. Now, do you consider yourself a comic yourself? I mean, do you tell jokes? Do people find you funny at the office? That kind of thing.
Well, harking back to my, I'm not good at anything in a world class way. If you put me in a room with, you know, five people, I'll probably be the funniest one. But if you put me in a room with 25 people, well, there's probably going to be somebody who's funnier than I am in that room. And humor doesn't translate directly across art forms. So being able to write a funny joke in three panels, believe it or not, doesn't really qualify me even to write jokes in one panel. If I tried tomorrow to do a Gary Larson Far Side type of panel that was just one joke, I don't think I could get it published, because it's just – even that is different enough from what I'm good at. So I do have a pretty big speaking part of my life. I've done hundreds and hundreds of paid speaking gigs, and those are sort of stand-up comedy. But I'm usually doing friendly audiences that already like Dilbert and already like me. So it's a different level of difficulty. I'm already starting ahead.
Do you think that one of your skills is hearing a story about somebody, about a coworker situation work, and figuring out like, hey, I think that's going to be funny? Or like, you must have to kind of translate when somebody tells you a real life vignette to, oh, this will make a good cartoon.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, the trick to finding out what will be a good cartoon is if you laugh before the joke. In other words, if I tell you the setup and that makes you laugh before you've even heard the punchline, then I know that's going to work. So that's what I'm always looking for. So, you know, earlier when I said, this is one of the suggestions somebody gave me earlier, that you go on vacation and your boss keeps emailing you and telling you to work. Now, you might not laugh out loud at that, but the first time you hear that, there's almost an involuntary, oh, you know, like you're – so what I look for is a actual literal body reaction. So the first time I see an idea or I think of it, I have to feel it first. So I'll give you an example. Yesterday I'm at the gym. I'm working out. I've got my headphones on. I'm just in my own little world. And for whatever reason, and I don't usually think of comic ideas at the gym, but I just thought of the fact that maybe the reason we can't develop artificial intelligence is because we imagine that we're smarter than we are, and that to make something, a device that acted like a human, you'd have to program in stupidity, not intelligence. And then I was imagining my character Wally, being tasked with developing AI, but they put him on it because he's the worst, most lazy, useless employee, but he would be assigned to it only because they didn't think it was going to be a project that would work no matter who you assigned it to, but they want to keep the budget alive and say they're working on something sexy. So that's sort of like the perfect corporate experience. I was actually on that project, by the way, not artificial intelligence, but I was assigned to a project back in my Pacific Bell days that sounded good because we needed that in the portfolio, things that sounded good. But nobody expected them to work. And they even told me that. I was like, well, this is just to protect the budget, you know, make it sound like we're working on some sexy stuff. So when you hear that sort of idea, you don't need the punchline. It's already funny. just that it exists, just that's a real thing.
Tell me a little bit about, over the years, has Dilbert like waxed and waned in popularity, or has it just always been on the increase? Did it grow exponentially, then kind of level off? Give me a feel for kind of how the popularity of Dilbert has come and gone since the years you've been doing Dilbert.
Well, there's sort of a baseline, recognition of the character, baseline, have you ever seen it once? That grows forever. So, because once somebody's seen it once, they've always seen it once, and the number of new people just keeps growing. So the people who've been exposed to it goes up forever. The people who read newspapers is going down. The people reading it online is going up. And then there's sort of a licensing life that has its own arc. You know, several years in, it's not big enough to do any licensing deals. Then for 5 years, it's all the world wants is Dilbert on a coffee cup, Dilbert on a shirt, Dilbert TV show. And then because it's an adult product and adults sort of get used to stuff and they say, okay, we're done with that now, you expect sort of a 5 to 7 year arc if you're lucky. That's a long time. And then you expect that to trail off really indefinitely. So the hot part of it, the licensing, is trailed off. The sort of the general icon value of it, the recognition, the name, household name value of it, that just keeps increasing.
Do you get? How do you feel about Dilbert? Are you tired of him at this point, or do you still like him just as much as when you created? What is your relationship with the character, and how has that changed over the years?
Well, I would say at the moment it's getting harder to sit down and draw more Dilbert cartoons, in part because there's so many other interesting distractions. You know, I'd love to write another book. I'd rather finish the movie script of Dilbert that I started. Mm. I have two non-Dilbert books in my mind. I'm working on a startup. I wouldn't mind, you know, three other apps that I have in mind. I'd love to do all that stuff. So it's really about competition for my time, but you know, I'm never going to complain that my job of writing three sentences and a couple of pictures is so hard.
Well, do you ever see yourself starting another cartoon character, a spin-off of Dilbert or something like that? Do you ever see that as a possibility? Or
it turns out that that's harder than you think, and the reason is it's the comparison problem. Dilbert started poorly and got good because I got good at doing that one type of comic. And people got used to it, and I found out what they liked, and I changed it until they liked it even better. If I were to launch something new today, 100% of the people who saw it would say, well, that looks like it has, you know, it's not bad, but it's not Dilbert. So therefore, you're getting worse. And now the truth is that any new comic would start bad, and you know, if you let it, it would get good. If you tried to look at the first season of The Simpsons, judged by today's standards, it's unwatchable. Same thing for Family Guy. And there are probably quite a few comics and newspapers that have the same quality. The first year you just would never want to see. But there was something about it. Either it had some X factor or some interest that gave you time to develop it. And it's the time to develop it that makes it a good product. But let me add that I did introduce sort of a new comic called Robots Read News, but I publish it mostly on Twitter and in my blog. And it's literally a robot who never moves, and he just sits at a desk looking straight at you. And all three panels are the same art. So I just, you know, it's just the same piece, and I change the words. So part of the funny is that a robot doesn't need to move to talk, so he's just sitting there. Surprisingly, people didn't care that he doesn't move. And that was so different from Dilbert that people actually liked that.
Will Dilbert ever retire? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I keep him about 30 years old, so I don't think he'll retire because he'll be at that age. I've often thought what I would do if I decided to retire. And I thought I would hate to go out boring. You know, I wouldn't want to just say, well, next year I'm retiring. You know, I'll just walk away. I think I would do something dangerous with Dilbert. I'd give him a sex change operation. I'd make him, you know, I'd make him go work for Anonymous and go to jail for the rest of his life when he gets caught. I'd kill him. You know, I'd do something.
Interesting. Well, Scott, it's been a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate your taking the time. It was a real honor to talk with you. When you figure out what next to do with Dilbert, you'll have to come back and tell me about it.
Thanks. I'd love to.
This is Richard Hsu and Scott Adams. Thanks.